This is an iHeart podcast.
Palace intrigue in Washington, D.C. We'll talk about that, some foreign policy talk, the latest and worst on Gretchen Whitmer, all that coming up on I'm Right. All right, before we get to the endless drama, very interesting drama taking place in Washington, D.C. and in our nation, we have to do something awful, but something that's important. Honoring the fallen, fallen who die in training, as you well know, if you watch this show, we do this every single time. We get somebody who dies in military training. This is something that happens a lot. Being in the military is a dangerous job. It could be a very dangerous job. It takes lives even when there's no war going on. And one Sergeant Jorge, Air Force Staff Sergeant Jorge Delgado, traveling to work in a Humvee, 5 injured, but Jorge Delgado, 37 years old, lost his life, gave his life for this country. And of course, Independence Day is upon us. So let's, you know, look, we don't have to spend Independence Day crying and weeping by any means, but let's do take a moment, whatever you're doing, fireworks, hot dogs, I hope you're doing all those things. Take a moment and remember people like Jorge Delgado and all the others who've given their lives for this country. It is, what's that old saying that's gotten cheesy now, but it's very, very true. Freedom isn't free. It's not free. People paid for that freedom with blood. Remember that. All right? All right. Now let's talk about something I guess we're calling on this show House of the Donkey. It's the Game of Thrones reference, House of the Dragon, whatever, House of the Donkey, because it's Democrats that are friggin' screwing everything up. Now, it's getting interesting. When I say interesting, I'm not doing my normal, they're going to get rid of Joe Biden thing. I'm telling you, we might have a new nominee for president, or at least Joe Biden won't be the nominee for president in 24 hours, 48 hours. By the time we get back from Independence Day break, that's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we might very well have a new nominee. That's what's happening here. So let's give you the latest and worst on all this. According to the New York Times, now I realize that's saying a lot. You know, the New York Times is about as evil and dishonest a media organization as humanly possible. The New York Times, they're saying Joe Biden is, well, weighing whether or not he's going to continue. And here's the thing. You ever hear this about normal people? Maybe you're going through this. Maybe you've gone through this. But I bet you've heard it before. As soon as you start thinking about retiring, you're retired. It's inevitable. As soon as the thought starts going into your mind, you know, maybe I should hang it up. Maybe I'm all done here. Then the clock is already ticking. Being president is brutally stressful. Being president while running for president is twice as stressful. Doing all this with dementia is virtually impossible. If this story is true, and he's really now weighing it, no more digging his feet in, we're going forward, and now he's weighing it, he's probably out. Now, that brings us to some very, very interesting things that are happening around here. What's one of the major things? One of the major things is Hunter Biden. Now, this made a bunch of waves yesterday. You've heard a lot of this for the last 24 hours. But after the debate, Joe Biden gathered with family and allegedly, they were discussing whether or not his campaign should move forward. We've heard enough rumors that we can probably safely assume they did discuss it. Family got together. Hunter, Joe, Jill, they all got together discussing things. Hunter, after that meeting, has been attached to Joe Biden's side, right by his side, like a barnacle on a boat. Now, people have been yelling and screaming, how we got the crackhead in the White House now? Why do we have a convicted felon in the White House now? Well, allow me to explain. Obviously, those are valid concerns, very, very valid concerns. But why is Hunter Biden there? The Bidens, over the last, since the debate ended, actually since about 5 minutes after the debate started, the Bidens have been losing friends. Now, none of those people were actually friends, but allies, supporters, we love Joe, go Joe. They've just been falling off like you can't imagine since about 5 minutes after the debate started. When the Biden family gathered to discuss whether or not he was going to move forward, Joe was looking left and he was looking right, and there weren't that many people there around him. Hunter Biden, not only his son, longtime business associate, was one of those people. When you're running out of friends, you tend to turtle up and gather around you the few people in your life you feel you can trust. If you want to know why Hunter Biden is there, it's because Joe Biden has lost more friends in the last 24, 48, 72 hours than a lottery winner who goes bankrupt. He's just running out of people who have his back. And now the backbiting, the whispers, the snipping is starting to leak out of the White House. We know White House staffers are starting to tell the media that they're scared. I can't use that word on our family show here, but they're scared a lot day to day of Joe Biden. Now, what's the deal here? Well, for one, I'm sure they are scared of Joe Biden. Joe Biden has been sold to the American people as the nice old man. Now, why was that? Well, they were trying to, the media and Joe Biden, they were trying to build the anti-Trump. You know, Trump with his more rough, blunt, in-your-face style. They wanted to make Biden the anti-Trump. Hey, our guy's something, your guy's not. Look how nice he is. What a good man. A good man. They kept telling you that. But that's not Joe Biden. He may be old, feeble, his brain may have melted into the pavement, but he's not a good man and certainly not a nice man, never has been. He's never, ever, ever had that reputation. From his earliest days in Washington, D.C., Joe Biden has been known in political circles as being a grade A jerk. And he's been a jerk. It's not like he's been a jerk behind closed doors, on camera, for the majority of his political career. And I don't just mean to Republicans, right? Okay, you're having a debate with Republicans. His own staffers, reporters, Joe Biden belittles people, talks down to people. Joe Biden's been a jerk forever. Well, here's the terrible thing about dementia, whatever the case, whatever he has, Alzheimer's, whatever it is you start to lose pieces of yourself. And It's an awful thing. I hope you never have to go through it. I've seen it in my own life. It's awful. And eventually, you're left with just kind of the bare bones of what you are. You've lost so much, but you're left with the bare bones of what you are. Joe Biden's been a jerk his whole career. Now he's an old jerk who can't talk anymore. Of course he's snapping at people. That's also part of dementia. Of course the staffers are scared. The real story is the staffers are starting to leak. You see all these people who work in the White House, they're all ambitious political people. All of them view the White House job as a meal ticket to something better. Maybe you're going to go at a higher ranking position in this senator's office. Maybe you're going to go work for CNN, the DNC, who knows? But the White House is a nice thing to have on the resume. And right now they're all looking at Joe Biden's poll numbers. They're freaking out. And now the whispering and the backbiting begins. And that brings us to the meeting that happened today in the White House. A governor's meeting. Powerful governors. New York, California. But we'll get back to California in a moment. Before we get to Gavin Newsom and all the other governors that are meeting in the White House, you need to know something about politics, something you probably already know, but allow me to explain. A governor is a very powerful thing. I know that's, but it's a very, very powerful thing. And the governor's coalitions on the Democrat side and the Republican side are extremely powerful. The Republican Governors Association, maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't, but in political circles, it's a juggernaut political organization. When you become a Republican governor of any state, you will become part of the Republican Governors Association. You will raise gobs of money. They swing a big stick. Governors swing a big stick, and the Democrats have a mirror of that. To have governors of several states, I just named the two most powerful, New York and California, but there are so many there, Minnesota, others. To have the governors gather in the White House is a really, really, really big deal. And we know now from reports what they're gathering to discuss. Joe Biden has to sell them. This isn't a bunch of governors showing up in the White House doing, what did Gavin Newsom say today, that he was just showing to support Joe? No, that's not what's happening here. The governors aren't showing up at the White House hat in hand, Joe, will you love me? Governors are going to sit down in front of President Joe Biden, sat down in front of President Joe Biden. We weren't in there, so we don't know. But Joe had to sell himself. Hey, Joe, how are you going to win? What's the plan? Hey, Joe, did you see the poll numbers? Hey, Joe, what's the plan? And I would love to have been there for that conversation between him and Gavin Newsom. Remember, Joe's already called Gavin the next guy.
I want to talk about Governor Newsom. I want to thank him. He's been one hell of a governor, man. Matter of fact, he could do anything you want. He could have the job I'm looking for.
Oh, he's looking for it too, Joe. And that brings us to the elephant in the room. Dome. You see, it's one thing to get rid of Joe. They would have got rid of Joe 5 minutes after the debate if it wasn't for Dome. Vice President Kamala Harris is the problem for Democrats right now. It's actually not Joe Biden. If she wasn't there, they could dump that old fool, get him to hand the nomination to Newsom or somebody and move on about their day. How do you get over Dome? How do you get around Dome? She's the vice president. Vice president's the heir apparent. How do they handle this? And look, Dome has her own surrogates in the media, James Clyburn being a very powerful one out there talking about it.
This body should not in any way do anything to work around Ms. Harris. We should do everything we can to bolster her, whether it's in second place or at the top of the ticket.
I'm going to explain something to you, and this is a little in the weeds, and then we're going to wrap this up. We have too many guests, too much to talk to. James Clyburn may be somebody you don't even know. He's a congressman from South Carolina. Who's going to know that? James Clyburn is a majorly powerful political figure in the Democrat Party because James Clyburn is hugely in control of the black vote in South Carolina. And if you want to be the Democrat nominee for president, you really, 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 really need the black vote in South Carolina. It's why Joe Biden won the nomination last time. He and James Clyburn hooked up. James Clyburn decided to back Joe. Joe wins South Carolina. La-di-da. He's the nominee, and then he's president. I don't know how they're going to get around Dome. If Joe Biden does drop out, and he very well may, and I mean soon, we might have Kamala Harris as the Democrat nominee. I know, I can't. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. We have so much to update you on. My goodness, we have a stacked show for you tonight. Before we get to any of that, I want to get to this. I want to get to dream powder. Almost sounds illegal, doesn't it? No, I swear it's not only legal, it's all natural. Bean sells it. It's dream powder. I actually had a wonderful cup last night. It's hot chocolate, essentially, but it's for sleep. Melatonin, couple things in it. And you just drift off to sleep and you have the most deep, restful sleep. But the best part is not that. You can take a lot of things that'll help you sleep. The best part is when you wake up, you feel so good, refreshed, not like you're half dead still, refreshed. You want a cup of hot chocolate that makes you sleep like that? Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. 40% off is what that gives you. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
I want to say something. Somebody today said that Michigan was gone. Michigan's not gone. We know how to win the state. We're going to win the state. And the campaign needs to listen to people like Governor Whitmer and me and my other colleagues who know how to win this state.
I am curious what the answers would be. How does one go about winning Michigan? I bet you Christina has some theories on that. Joining me now, independent journalist. She did something you really need to go see, Kidnap and Kill. It's about the FBI, Christina Urso. Christina, okay, how does one win Michigan? I'm very curious your thoughts on this.
Well, I think that they engage in voter fraud. I'm not quite sure, you know. I know that there are a bunch of voters suing the Secretary of State right now, Jocelyn Benson, Dana Nassel, and Gretchen Whitmer, over changes to the election law in Michigan, because they're alleging that these changes, Proposal 2, cannot guarantee a fair election in Michigan.
Okay, can you explain, just briefly, Gretchen Whitmer, we know, at least kind of, but most people don't know Jocelyn Benson. Who is this young lady?
Yeah, she's the Secretary of State. She's part of the trifecta there in Michigan. You've got Gretchen Whitmer, the governor. You have Jocelyn Benson, the Secretary of State. And then you have Dana Nassel, the Attorney General. So you have the three of them there. I call them the Michigan Democrat trifecta that pretty much control the entire state of Michigan. And this is how.
All right, I really wanted to talk to you today about the whistleblower. In fact, the newest FBI whistleblower, because obviously that there's been a few of them by now, but the newest complaint alleges the FBI purging anyone to the right of center. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is it's interesting. You know, we already had a number of FBI whistleblowers come forward, the suspendables, to talk about how the FBI is purging anybody, basically anybody who dissents from the agency. And this latest whistleblower to come forward is an FBI supervisor on the East Coast. This is a registered Democrat, by the way. This is not somebody who is by any means conservative or right-leaning. He's come forward to blow the whistle against other high-ranking officials in his division for egregious political discrimination against conservatives, Trump supporters, anybody who questioned the pandemic policies of 2020 as it relates to vaccines.
Okay, so what exactly is going on? What is he alleging specifically?
So he's alleging that high-ranking officials in the FBI are discriminating against other agents in the FBI when it comes up for their security clearance review process. They're asking them political questions. They're asking them about if they're Trump supporters. They ask them their thoughts on the vaccines, and then they're pulling their clearances and trying to purge them from the agency if they're right-leaning, if they dissent from the official narrative. And so now we have a registered Democrat, an FBI supervisor, coming forward to blow the whistle on his colleagues. I think that's good news. That gives me a little bit of hope that maybe there are others, and I think he's indicated there are other agents in the FBI who see what's happening at the top levels of the FBI, how they're purging people from the agency, and they don't like it. They don't agree with it. And I'd like to see even more agents come forward to blow the whistle on what the FBI is doing.
Why do you think more haven't? Why? Obviously, I'm thrilled that we have guys like Steve and Kyle and Garrett and others. I'm thrilled. It takes a lot of bravery, but there are, 35,000 employees at the FBI? I may be off, but I'm not that far off. And we have, five? It's less than 10. Where are the rest of them?
Well, hopefully this emboldens some of them. I mean, it's good to see a supervisor coming forward. But really, if you're still working in the FBI today and you've seen everything they're doing and you are silent, you're complicit. And I think for a lot of these people, they just want to keep their head down and collect a paycheck. They want to get their government pension. They don't want to stand up also because they've seen what happens to agents who stand up. Look what they did to Steve Friend, to Marcus Allen. You know, they'll suspend these people, not pay them for years, but not totally fire them. They retaliate against them. So I think that's a big reason why. And I'd like to see the DOJ Inspector General do something about this. We need some investigation into the FBI. And as it relates to Gretchen Whitmer, by the way, who is now apparently campaigning, potentially, she sent her team to DC last month. Jill Biden has just arrived in Michigan. She's visiting Grand Rapids and Traverse City. She's not meeting with Whitmer at all. Gavin Newsom's in Michigan today campaigning for Biden. So I think that that's very interesting. But she's obviously, you know, campaigning to run. And I think that we need an investigation into her role as a co-conspirator in a joint venture conspiracy on the part of the FBI, the DOJ, Michigan State Police, and the Michigan Attorney General's office to deprive American citizens of their rights and to frame them in a fake conspiracy. And we can talk about her role in that, if you like.
Please do. What's her role in that?
Yeah, so Whitmer's team was kept apprised of the so-called investigation by the FBI. And as it was getting near the election in 2020, so once again, the FBI was looking to influence an election, their hoax plot was falling apart. So they needed to up the ante and arrange two hastily constructed recons of her vacation cottage. Gretchen Whitmer, with her team, her security detail and the Michigan State Police and the Michigan Attorney General's office, coordinated the recon of her vacation cottage. She knew in advance, she planned it before the men who were framed in the hoax knew anything about it. Eric Molitor was duped into going into the daytime recon, the daytime ride along with the FBI driving the vehicle. He had no idea where they were going before he got in the car. He didn't find out until they were on the way. And during the state trial for him, the FBI actually got caught trying to alter timestamps and fabricate timestamps to make it appear he knew where they were going before they picked him up. They tried to change it and put in something he said 4 hours later. They actually got caught while they were doing it on the stand. So I'd like to see an investigation into what she knew, when she knew it. We know that she wasn't a victim in this. She made also a highly prejudicial 3-minute long victim impact statement at these men's trial where she claims she scans the crowds. You know, she was scared for her life. Well, she has a book coming out next month, also perfectly timed for the election, and she's doing interviews. She just recently admitted she's never once feared for her life. Imagine that, after giving, you know, this statement saying she was in fear for her life at these men's sentencing. It's disgusting.
Yeah, of course. It is. It really is. Christina, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Let's talk about talk, pure talk, like what I did there. Anyway, let's talk about your cell phone. You see, we all have one. You pay your bill every month, don't you? You probably pay it automatically. I bet you do. Well, you know that Verizon's a horrible company. AT&T, T-Mobile, these companies, they hate you. They campaign against you. You pay them to campaign against your culture and your values. Did you know that? You don't have to do that, though. You want a cell phone? How about you pay less? I pay half of what I was paying at T-Mobile. How about you pay less? Same great 5G networks, you're not losing coverage, and you pay a company that actually shares and promotes your values. That's what Pure Talk does. Switch to Pure Talk. It's easy. It's 10 minutes on the phone. Online. You keep your phone, you keep your number, whatever you want. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with. Look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Okay, obviously everyone saw the debate. Everyone knew what was happening. We can argue, and we have been arguing about what that means domestically, but foreign policy-wise, the world seems like it's a little nutty right now. Seems like it's kind of on fire. How much of it has to do with who the commander-in-chief is? Joining me now, Dr. James Robbins, Dean of Academics at the Institute of World Politics. Okay, doctor, or I guess I'm supposed to call you Jim. Sorry, it's out of habit. Jim, America being strong, having a strong, decisive leader, how much does it matter? We're arrogant, I realize that. I'm guilty of that myself. But is it really important, or is it not that big of a deal?
Well, it's really important because deterrence is the main way to keep things from bad happening in the international community. And to the extent that we're strong, that deters the bad guys. You know, peace through strength, that's our policy. So if we have a leader who seems uncertain or, you know, not quite there all the time, then it doesn't matter what our capabilities are. It shows our adversaries that our intent, our leadership, may not be able to respond to whatever bad things they're going to do.
Disaster after disaster has befallen us foreign policy-wise, especially over the last 3 years, from embarrassing little things like the Gaza pier, which is now no longer, to the Afghanistan withdrawal. We could go down the list. Is this them on the move because they think they can get away with it, or is this just a pattern of how the world works?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but definitely America's adversaries can look at right now as an opportunity because we have a foreign policy team that probably isn't as strong as ones that we've had in the past. We have a commander-in-chief who's clearly not there all the time. And so if enemies want to make a move, now would be a good time to do it.
Yeah, that would be a very good time to do it. Okay, let's focus on a place that's gotten a lot of attention, Ukraine. Okay, Russia invades Ukraine. They've taken some territory. They are holding said territory. And now we have this horrific artillery war where men are dying in droves. Why is this still going on? A negotiated peace has been the whole history of the world's warfare, and yet that somehow is beyond the pale here. What am I missing?
Well, it's extremely difficult because obviously it's not in our interest to see the Russians overwhelm the Ukrainians. It would be great if Ukraine could take their territory back. But we haven't given them enough aid to mount a really strong offensive. So now they're just an attrition warfare situation. And Ukraine cannot win an attrition war. Russia has 3 to 4 times the mobilization base of Ukraine. Putin doesn't care how many people die. He'll empty his prisons. He'll just send people there. He doesn't really care. So the Ukrainians are in a tough situation. If they could mount an offensive to take back a substantial amount of land, you know, enough to give a good position for bargaining, that would be preferable. But as it stands, it's just going to maintain an attrition warfare situation, people dying by the thousands, no territory changing hands, and they just can't win that way.
Okay, so I saw a report out of the Telegraph this morning that Ukraine's not going to be allowed to join NATO because they're too corrupt. I've been told repeatedly that this is the fountain of democracy and we're fighting for freedom. Which is it? What's going on over there?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I can't say every country in NATO is completely pristine and uncorrupt. I mean, we would hope so. You know, who knows? But I mean, the idea that that would be the reason, I mean, NATO is a strategic alliance. It doesn't really matter who's corrupt and who isn't. It's a question of will that country help the alliance or not. NATO could expand to Ukraine. It might not expand to Ukraine. Politically, right now, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But it's interesting that Vladimir Putin, who said he went to war in Ukraine in order to prevent NATO from growing, now NATO has two members that you never would have expected, Finland and Sweden. And Finland alone doubles NATO's border with Russia. So at least from Putin's point of view, the strategic genius in the Kremlin, he actually expanded NATO through his invasion, not kept it smaller.
Okay, so where does Putin go from here? Obviously, no one's rooting for Putin because he's a dirtball, but isn't he getting backed into a bit of a corner here?
In some ways, but I mean, not really. He was already an international pariah. The sanctions that we put on Russia haven't really been effective. They're using China as a backdoor to export oil and other things that they need to keep their economy going. Their economy is actually growing at a pace similar or greater to ours. So that side of this isn't working. He's losing a lot of his men and material, but he doesn't seem to care. He just keeps ramping up the tank production. And what could be his next move? I think he's just going to continue to try to reassemble the Russian Empire, maybe, you know, get a deal with Belarus to annex them, threaten Poland, threaten the Baltic states. I mean, the man will do whatever he can do for the rest of his life to expand Russia.
I want to talk about Poland, actually, specifically for a moment. Can he just take Poland? I have always thought this was absolutely ridiculous. Obviously, a head-to-head war between Poland and Russia would end in Russia's favor, but Poland is not just some lay-down country where he can storm in there, can he?
No, this isn't 1939. They're not going to just walk in there like Stalin did. Poland has a very modern, very advanced defense force. They just got rid of a bunch of their surplus weapons that they sent into Ukraine and then rearmored with stuff from South Korea, and also NATO interoperable material. Poland is very strong. Plus, there's a U.S. troop presence there, and it is likely, I mean, it is completely likely that were Poland attacked, just simply attacked by Russia, that the U.S. would intervene. I mean, it would be a NATO Chapter 5 thing. There'd be no question that NATO would be involved in that.
Okay, now let's focus on the other conflict, Israel. Israel, they're apparently, and you never know what to believe because everyone lies about everything, but they're apparently close to finishing off Hamas, but that doesn't address Hezbollah in the north. Is this thing going to die when the last one in Hamas dies? Where does it go from here?
Well, it would be hard to stamp out all of the Hamas fighters, obviously. Taking out the Hamas leadership, that would be extremely useful. Hopefully they're closing in on them. Maybe they could even do something about the Hamas leadership in Qatar, you know, just on the side. With respect to Hezbollah and Lebanon, that is a much tougher nut to crack. But it does look like Israel is moving forces into position to take care of that. So there will probably be another conflict in the north coming. Frankly, I thought it was going to happen this week, but I mean, they're definitely ready to go. And it's just a question of whether Hezbollah is going to continue to escalate the conflict to a point where Israel just decides that, you know, it's time to take care of business.
Gotcha. Jim, thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right. Let's talk about something. Let's talk about the timeshare you think you're stuck in. You see, timeshare companies are awful. I don't have a better way to put it. Not all of them, of course, but most of them are awful. And this is what they do. This is what they do to everyone, so don't feel like you're alone. They sell you on the timeshare, you sign the contract, and you go enjoy it for a while, but then eventually you want out. Eventually you're done with it. But that's when they drop the bomb on you. Speaking of bombs, that's when they tell you, oh, no, you didn't read the contract, and no one ever reads all the contract. You're in this for life. I've heard stories of mothers passing away and the timeshare burden gets passed to the daughter. Are you stuck in a horrible situation? Are you stuck in a timeshare you don't want? Call Lone Star Transfer today, 844-310-2646. Let them get you out of your timeshare. They're successful 99% of the time. We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
Well, speaking of polls, why don't we step away from politics briefly and let's talk a little history and patriotism, things like that. After all, Independence Day is upon us. Poll just came out saying only 41% of Americans are extremely proud to be an American. And don't ignore that. Look, all politics, everything else aside, that's a really big deal. Patriotism is one of the essential elements of a society, of any society. If you have people who want to be there and feel blessed to be there, society in general will prosper. And if they don't feel like that, you're probably in a bit of trouble. Anyway, we'll talk about that and some sweet World War II history. I'm about to nerd out on some naval stuff with Nathan Canastero. He is the author of the book, The Mighty Moo. Why do I keep screwing up The Mighty Moo? I keep wanting to call it The Mighty Cow Pen, but that's the name of the ship. Anyway, Nathan, before we get to the ship, the Navy, that wonderful carrier that was a warrior for this country and the great men who served on it, patriotism. What happened between the 1940s and now? And I know that's a very long, complicated answer. You don't have to take up 2 hours to give it, but I don't like it that people don't love it here. I love it here.
I mean, I do too. I'm sort of an old-fashioned traditional patriot. You know, if you ask 100 people that question, you'd probably get 100 different answers. But what worries me is that politics and patriotism have gotten entangled a little bit. And there's people in this country sometimes have a misconception that you can't be patriotic unless you're 100% in approval of everything the government is and is doing and who's in charge. And it shouldn't be that way. You know, you can honor our country and the values and ideals that it stands for without necessarily being partisan. And I think it's kind of like a marriage contract in that way. You're in it for the good times and the bad. And honestly, when things are going worse, that's probably when you need to be the most patriotic, because that's when your country needs you the most.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, you know what? We're done with politics. I want to talk about some World War II history. I just nerd out on this stuff. What in the world is the Mighty Moo? Most people have never even heard of it.
Well, yeah, it was a light aircraft carrier. And, you know, when you're thinking about a World War II aircraft carrier, this is not that ship. You think about the Intrepid or the Lexington or the Yorktown, the big ships that are in museums today. But the Cowpens was one of nine light aircraft carriers that the Navy made between 42, 43. Essentially, they had a gap. They were losing carriers faster than they could build them. And so they cranked together nine of these sort of mid-sized ships. They put a flat top on a light carrier or light cruiser in order to make them work. Just sort of, they were a desperate stopgap measure until the big carriers started arriving on the scene in mid-43, late of that year, yeah.
Nathan, you call them light carriers. For those who aren't naval historians, they might be confused what that means. It's more than just lighter, isn't it? Why? What makes a light carrier versus a big boy carrier?
Well, they're small. These were not pretty ships. Let's be honest here. They're about two-thirds of the length of an actual aircraft carrier. They only carried 33 planes. They had a very narrow flight deck, about 73 feet. That seems like a really big space, but if you're landing a plane with a 42 or 54 foot wingspan on it, that you're really sort of threading the needle. They're kind of a bootleg carrier. You know, the hull was never intended to be an aircraft carrier at all. And so they were cramped, they were dangerous, they were unstable in high seas. They were kind of a mess for a lot of different reasons. And the only reason that the Navy wanted them at all is because the big carriers kept getting sunk. I mean, if you think about it, we started the war with six aircraft carriers, and by the end of 42, we were down to two. I think a lot of Americans forget how badly that first year of the war was going. I can't even imagine the political firestorm in this country if we went to war and lost two-thirds of our aircraft carriers in a year. So it's a mark of the Navy's sort of desperation that they take these very inferior ships with so many problems and send them out into battle.
Tell us about the crew of these boats. Was it the creme de la creme? Who did they drag onto these light carriers that tip over in the open ocean?
Well, you know, the Navy was going from something like 130,000 people to several million in the space of about 2 years there. So the vast bulk of people who were assigned aboard this ship were reservists. These are folks that had, most of them had joined the Navy voluntarily to avoid being drafted into the Army. And so none of them had any seagoing experience, very, very few. There were only a handful of men aboard the Cowpens that were sort of what we might consider professional Navy and that they were Naval Academy grads. But these were, you know, talk about patriotism. This was a sample of America, big cities, small towns, farm boys, factory workers, people from all walks of life, all different regions. And, you know, and they sort of thrown into this war together. You just talk about even the pilots. The Cowpen's greatest fighter ace was a former insurance agent from Indianapolis. one of her former captains worked his way up from the enlisted ranks, and he never graduated from college at all. He was studying mining engineering at UCAL. You know, they were just kind of this crazy sampling of America. And to include my grandfather, who served aboard, he was a 22-year-old man from upstate New York. He was a carpenter, never been outside of his hometown, you know, and to be suddenly thrown in this little tiny ship in a great big war was a heck of a shock for him.
Why do men like your grandpa, what drove them? It's one of the things I just find so endlessly fascinating as I was reading your book. Thank you for sending me that, by the way.
My pleasure.
And all the World War II books I read, I'm just blown away by the men and what drove them. And they were such fighters. They weren't just trying to get by. They weren't there for three hots and a cot. They wanted to take it to the enemy. What was it about those men?
Well, there's kind of a mix of things. The pilots were certainly that way. You know, if you were a pilot in World War II, it's an entirely volunteer profession. Casualty rates were high. The first squadron aboard the Cowpens had a 40% casualty rate by the time they came home after that first year. So, you know, these were guys who wanted to take it to the Japanese for what they did to us at Pearl Harbor. If you talk to the individual crewmen, some of them would say, well, I wanted to serve, but my dad or my grandfather or my uncle told me what World War I was like in the trenches, and I'd rather be aboard a Navy ship. You know, you take your meals with you. My grandfather felt a little bit of that, but we also had a Navy connection in our family. We're three generations Navy all the way back to World War I. Great grandpa earned the Navy Cross on convoy duty in the Atlantic. So for him to, you know, follow his dad's footsteps and join the Navy seemed to be a logical thing to do. And I mean, his sons went on to join the Navy in Vietnam. So, you know, it was a family tradition, and he wanted to follow up on it.
How about that? The book is The Mighty Moo. I encourage everybody to go pick it up. You will find it endlessly fascinating. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you so much for joining us. Highly, highly recommended. Well-written book. Very, very well-written. Interesting. All right. You like history stuff like that? You know, we have specials. We do history specials all the time, including WW2 specials. Do you want to go watch those? Thefirsttv.com/history. Go sign up, subscribe, go enjoy them at your leisure. All right? We'll be back.
Hey there, I'm Mary Catherine Hamm.
And I'm Carol Markowitz. We've been in political media for a long time.
Long enough to know that it's gotten, well, a little insane.
That's why we started Normally, a podcast for people who are over the hysteria and just want clarity.
We talk about the issues that actually matter to the country without panic, without yelling, and with a healthy dose of humor.
We don't take ourselves too seriously, but we do take the truth seriously.
So if you're into common sense, sanity, and some occasional sass,
you're our kind of people.
Catch new episodes of Normally every Tuesday and Thursday
on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
All right, it is time to lighten the mood, and Independence Day is upon us, the day where we celebrate breaking away from those dirty British. And I don't know if I've ever seen a video more full of freedom than this one right here.
Thank you.
And maybe that was too much patriotism for you. Maybe you're sitting there saying, Jesse, please, no more. I'm overdosing. It's too much freedom. Well, if that's the case, maybe you should shut it off because we're hammering you with a double dose today. Here's another one.
Bagel, bagel. Bagel, tear. Put it in reverse, tear. Put it in reverse. Oh, Lord. Lord, please. Ow, Lord.
I'll see you Monday.
This is an iHeart podcast.